There are many kinds of museums, but museum goers only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. What exactly is an outsider artist? Do we even call them that anymore? In recent years, the term has shifted to self-taught artist. Sounds different, but does it mean the same thing? There's no better person to ask than Dr. Catherine Jenelson, the Mary and Dan Boone Curator of Folk and Self-Taught Art at the High Museum in Atlanta. The High recently opened two companion shows focusing on this very topic. One is Gatecrashers, the Rise of the Self-Taught Artist in America, and the other is Really Free, the Radical Art of Nellie Mae Rowe. Catherine curated both and joins us today. I know you've been working in this space, dealing with the work of self-taught artists for a long time. I know your dissertation was written on this topic. Where did the interest come from? Where did this curiosity to look into this corner of the art world begin for you?
What began for me while I was working in New York, and I was working as a journalist for an art market magazine called Art in Auction, and that just had me kind of covering all corners of the art world. You know, anything that sold was something that we covered in the magazine. And so I ended up stumbling upon self-taught artists through the Outsider Art Fair, which is an annual art fair that happens in New York in January. And just immediately felt a connection and felt the impact of the work of artists like Gordon Dyle and William Edmondson, whose work I encountered for the first time there. And I started to kind of self-teach about these artists by going into places like the American Folk Art Museum and Gallery Saint-Étienne, which are these really important institutions in New York that are mostly dedicated to self-taught artists, or self-taught artists are a big part of what they do. That's kind of how it started for me, was just realizing that there was this whole tradition in American art. And I mean, there are self-taught artists operating all over the world, but I was super interested in the position of self-taught artists within the United States from the get-go, and kind of why they seem to have had such a major impact throughout the 20th century and were still marginalized when it comes to, you know, mainstream art history courses, or, you know, a lot of museums and exhibitions. You know, these are stories that were still not told with frequency. And so that kind of led me back to graduate school, where I decided I really wanted to dig deep into especially the birth of interest in self-taught artists, and that's what Gatecrashers is about, and try to understand how these artists fit into the cultural history of our country.
You mentioned this at the beginning. You know, the term I think so many of us are familiar with, of course, is outside artist or outsider artist. And now the language has shifted to this concept of the self-taught artist, which in some ways is the same concept. But talk about, when did that language begin to change, and what does the, do you see different meaning in those two terms?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the kind of debate around terminology and the development of new terms to replace old terms, and which is better and which is worse, this has gone on for about 100 years, really, since self-taught artists first came into the mainstream art world. And you can read things that were written in the 1930s about, what do we call these artists? And, you know, is folk right? Is self-taught appropriate? And we really haven't resolved those debates. I think there are some people who today would say we shouldn't be using any label at all. We should just call these folks artists. And I agree with the sentiment behind that for sure. But I also, to me, what's really important is to recognize that being self-taught can be a position of power. It's not always a position of marginalization. And if we take away and kind of try to erase the ways that these artists did not have access to kind of mainstream pipelines to training, then that's taking away a big part of who they were. So for me, we used self-taught at the museum. We used folk as well sometimes. But, you know, no term is perfect. Even self-taught, which has kind of become a default term, it's a little misleading. And this is something that I get into with Gatecrashers too, because so many of these artists you know, were impacted by their trades. Often what they were doing for work was a method of training that impacted the way that they made art. They were impacted by other artists in their midst, even if they didn't go to art school. And, you know, many went to museums or looked at art in books, and they didn't get that kind of formal schooling, but they kind of knew what the conventions of mainstream art were in terms of, you know, a still life painting versus a self-portrait. And so it's all kind of mixed up, essentially. There's really no clear distinction between, you know, what absolutely makes a self-taught artist and how the word self-taught is different than a word like outsider. And I always kind of come back to this famous quote that an African-American art historian, pioneering curator of Black art in the Harlem Renaissance and beyond, Alain Locke, he said in the late 30s, he was like, art doesn't die of labels, it dies of neglect, meaning that the most important thing is to uphold the art and not to get lost in these kinds of never-ending debates around terminology and does it mean this or does it mean that.
Right, yeah, seeing it is the most important thing of all and experiencing it. You have this position that is literally in its name focused on self-taught artists and folk art. And I'm curious, how rare is that to have a curatorial position around the country that focuses specifically on this? Because it seems like it's tailor-made to your interests. Was it kind of a custom fit for you in that way? How did that happen? And like I said, how rare is that?
It was really, in a lot of ways, because the position at the High has been around since the 1990s. So there have been three curators in my position prior to me. I was the first curator to have this position endowed. So that kind of distinguishes, you know, the position as I inhabit it versus how it was for my predecessors. But, you know, there's very few curatorships that are so focused on folk and self-taught artists. Obviously, at places like the American Folk Art Museum, Smithsonian American Art Museum has a curator. Specifically, this material has been a great friend and mentor of mine. But, you know, for me, it was kind of crazy. I was in graduate school, and I mean, anyone getting an art history PhD, period, will encounter a lot the question of, you know, what are you going to do with that? And when I told people what I specialized in within American art, that I was most focused on self-taught artists, that was kind of like even more confusing to people where my career could possibly go from there. But it was very interesting. While I was in graduate school, you know, working on this dissertation, which, like I said in the beginning, I kind of knew what I wanted to write about from the moment that I entered graduate school. There was also this parallel resurgence of interest in self-taught artists happening within the mainstream art world. So like in 2013, which was my third year of graduate school, Massimiliano Gioni, who I forget his exact title, but I think he's artistic director of the New Museum, curated the Venice Biennale's kind of main exhibition and included so many self-taught artists in that, and in fact really centered the whole theme of the exhibition around a self-taught artist, Marino Arici. And things like that just kind of caused these shockwaves in the art world. The Met made its first acquisition of African-American artists without formal training from the South through the Silver and Beat Foundation in 2014. So there were just these things happening in the art world that kind of made it feel like this was actually an area that was very important all of a sudden, and not for the first time, as Gatecrasher demonstrates, but again, there was this resurgence of interest. And so for me, when I came out of graduate school, they were hiring for this position at the High, and it was just a really lucky kind of situation for me
that they needed somebody
who had my expertise.
Yeah. You mentioned your background in journalism. I thought that was kind of interesting, and certainly I think a little bit of a unique path for a curator, and many curators don't seem to come from that space. But you also mentioned the stories behind some of these artists, and it seems to me when I read about self-taught artists, so much of the attraction a lot of times is in their personal history and their narrative and how it's intertwined with their work. Do you think that that is a detriment at all to the work itself, that in some ways we are so dependent on kind of telling their story? Because oftentimes there are these kind of bootstrap narratives, kind of, you know, it's kind of rags to riches, or they kind of came in through a backdoor situation and kind of found their way into the limelight. Do you think that helps, hurts? Does it have any, you know, what kind of impact does that role in terms of the importance of the personal narrative have in their work?
I think it can be a negative thing. I had a great professor in graduate school, Dr. Bernie Herman, who kind of criticized this tendency that you're pointing to of always accentuating different dimensions of an artist's biography. And, you know, things that marginalize them, whether it's they had, you know, cognitive diversity in some way, so were, you know, being diagnosed with schizophrenic, or, you know, were born into slavery, or all these different things that really made an impact on their ability to pursue a formal, you know, path to artistry, and which sometimes, like, take up too much space, essentially, in the reception of their work. And we're so focused on these things that are the kind of marginalizing markers of these artists that it really can be a disservice to really respecting them and seeing them in their fullness. But I'm not a formalist. Like, I'm not somebody who believes that, you know, appreciation of art is so much around what lives in the object itself. Like you said, I'm a journalist. And so to me, the story is so important. And when you look at an artist like Nellie Mae Roe or any of the artists in Gatecrashers, you know, their artwork can stand without their story. It's just amazing just to look at it as a formal object. But when you learn, you know, what Nellie Mae Roe kind of, what she endured kind of in the experiences that she had as a Black woman living in the American South, it informs the work, because you start to understand that what you're seeing, even if you don't see, you know, her responding to the political events of her period in a very explicit way, I mean, just the act of making it all for her was a political act, was a radical act. And that's why we have the subtitle for that show. The full title is Really Free, The Radical Art of Nellie Mae Roe. And so I think that for me, not just in terms of the kind of the way that I'm attracted to narrative and understanding the way that somebody fits into a historical moment because of my background, but also just in terms of actually seeing the art and really understanding everything that artist went through. And how it's reflected, can be reflected in art in ways that you can't always see without knowing their history.
Let's talk about these shows specifically. So you have Gatecrashers, The Rise of the Self-Taught Artist in America. This is kind of the big umbrella show that looks at this topic pretty holistically, and many artists featured. And then you have this, and that's already open. And then you have this just open show, Really Free, The Radical Art of Nellie Mae Roe, that's kind of in some ways a focused exhibition, kind of looking at one specific artist in this space. They're companion pieces in some ways. You know, you kind of laid the groundwork with Gatecrashers, and then now this other show is opening to kind of expand on the ideas of that. How did you kind of land on these two, and specifically of all the artists that are in Gatecrashers, how did you end up focusing on Nellie Mae Roe when you probably could have done spotlight shows or breakouts of many of these artists?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think you put it exactly right. I mean, Gatecrashers, part of what's great about these shows being up at the same time is that when you see Gatecrashers, what it really is doing is explaining why self-taught artists first became so popular after World War I and kind of into mid-century. And that, like you said, lays the groundwork for really understanding that then, you know, later in the century, artists like Nellie Mae Roe come along and are kind of able to be seen in this way, in part because of this previous generation of gatecrashing artists, so people like John Cain or Grandma Moses or Horace Pippin, who are really the kind of, they were the most popular self-taught artists of their period in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, respectively. Nellie Mae Roe is really starting to make her own in the late 60s. So Gatecrashers is this group show that looks at so many artists and uses their work and their stories to, again, just understand, you know, how it was that self-taught artists first crashed the gates of the art world. Nellie Mae Roe is a show that's very focused on a single artist, this incredible woman who lived here in Atlanta. Essentially, she lived just outside the city in Bynum's, and who loved art making as a young girl, as so many self-taught artists do. They realize that they're artists in childhood, but they can't pursue that path for a variety of reasons. For Nellie Mae Roe, she had to work on the farm where she was raised, and then she, you know, married young, moved to Vining's, and took on domestic work to supplement her husband's income. And it's not until both her husbands, because she's widowed once and then she's widowed again, and her employers die, that she gets this opportunity to live alone, to maybe not worry so much about how she's being seen by people in her community. And that's when she kind of, as she puts it, returns to her playhouse and returns to this time in childhood when she loved making art. And she has what one journalist called an artistic explosion that explodes not just inside of her home, but all over the outside of it, because what she ends up doing is building what we call an art environment, you know, stringing decorations all through trees in her yard and building installations of all kinds of reused material into these amazing arrangements. She draws hundreds of drawings, And that's mostly what the show is comprised of, is her incredible drawings, which Sahai is super lucky to have this major collection of. We started collecting her work in 1980 when she was still alive. And then in 2003, we received this massive gift from Judith Alexander, who was an Atlanta art dealer that was a close friend of Rose at the end of her life and gave us this major gift of her work because she represented her in her gallery. So that's why part of why we have this Sunday Night Rose show, because we have this collection. It's a collection show. And it's the first time we've ever shown it, on this scale. It's the first major exhibition of Rose's work in 20 years. And it's not just because we have the collection that we're doing the show right now. I've been working on it and thinking about it since I joined the High in 2015, but the timing of it is really important because we're living in a moment where the art world in general is looking into its blind spots, right? And thinking about the ways that artists, especially of Rose's generation, have not been seen, especially Black women artists. And so you see so many Black women artists, whether it's Anna Amos or Alma Thomas or Howardina Pindell, people who have been working and working and working for decades, some of whom are still alive, and they're finally getting the recognition that they so long were not getting either in life or, earlier in their lives.
So, she was born in 1900. She starts really in earnest making most of this art in her late 60s after having lived, many lives up to that point. And you also mentioned someone like Grandma Moses and some of these people who came to be known as artists late in life. Do you think age has any role in their work, the topics they're interested in, the perspective that you have at that age? Yeah. How does that play into this work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, someone like Moses, she's painting her present to some degree, but she's also painting this kind of bygone era of, this golden age of American pre-industrial agrarian production that's her life because she was born in 1860 or 1861. And so she's looking back, right? And that's something that that people tend to do later in their lives. That's when you get the time and space, if you're lucky, to look back on your life. And for Ro, I think she also actually does paint in very different ways, her memories of life on the farm, because for her, it's not like she's painting these rural landscapes. She's painting, bringing the farm animals of her youth, so, roosters and donkeys and cows and bulls, like she's bringing them into conversation with her presence. So her art, her drawings are always this kind of like cacophonous party of all these different images and patterns and things from her present and things from her past. So she does that too, though, to some degree. She brings these memories of her youth. But what she does that's really important and is a big focus of the show and the book, and by the way, both exhibitions do have books, is that Rose kind of returning to her childhood very actively, right? Like she says she's going to play in her playhouse. She talks about making art, always in terms of this space of play and this idea that she's kind of reclaiming this state of freedom that, so many people associate with childhood. And unfortunately for her, it was limited because of her race and her class and how much work she had to do as a kid. But anyway, it's just to also say that age plays an important role, and not just the age that they are in terms of like maybe this is a time in their life where they can put aside the labor that they had to perform for their hardworking, young adult and adult lives. But also because they're returning, they're returning to either these memories of the past or even like this state of youth that they recognize as past, but that they associate, especially in Eleni Rowe, with their kind of initial love of making art.
Yeah, and it has this kind of beautiful abstraction that we all have with memory, right? The way we abstract our memories, the further we are away from them, they change, they're not snapshots perfectly. We kind of think about things differently and interpret them different ways. And it also changes the way you think of that kind of misplaced idea of the kind of angry young man artist whose period of most fruitful work is in, at a young age while they're burning bright and hot. And, there's this whole other idea of saying, you're going to kind of pack up all your experiences, all your memories, and then use them as this big toolkit later in life to create this body of work. It's a pretty special thing that you're focusing on.
Oh yeah, and it's so special, and it's something that to me is part of why again and again the stories of self-taught artists just blow me away, is because it is like they're you know, they're storing this up their whole lives. And there's this kind of germ, this like seed that they've protected their whole life that finally like gets to grow and sprout in often, you know, the last decades of their life. And that to me, like, just says so much about, you know, the power of art, and that it's so important that, you know, people are able to hang on to it and protect it within themselves for their whole lives, no matter what happens to them, and then finally give it space. And that's just like, I mean, I wish for all of them that they'd had that opportunity to do it sooner. But nonetheless, it's still something that I just think is really amazing.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Levels. Listen, we're 6 seasons into this thing, and we've been fortunate all along to have the support of Levels. Just try competently hanging a framed painting, poster, or photograph without one. It's nearly impossible. There's just no excuse for not using a Level, and whether you know it or not, you've already got one in your pocket. That's right, your smartphone is a Level. And if it's not already installed, well, like they say, there's an app for that. The point is this: find balance. Get some Levels in your life.
As we wrap up, the final thing I'd like to touch on is the idea that, you know, this Gatecrashers exhibition, I know your PhD dissertation was written and has the same title. You know, this is the topic you've been interested in for a long time. Do you see this exhibition or both of these exhibitions in some ways as kind of a culmination of all the work you've been doing up till this point, meaning like you've kind of been working towards this moment? Not that it's like a apex, but, you know, this is kind of some space you've been moving towards these last years.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there have been all of these other moments leading up to the actual opening of the exhibition, you know, where the research that I've done and the writing that I've done have started to feel, you know, like they're at this important moment of finally being seen, because I published the book Gatecrashers last year, actually, and we finished the Nellie Mae Rowe catalog, you know, in the spring. And so it's not quite like this moment of, it makes this moment a little anticlimactic in some ways, because there are so many things you do along the way that feel like you're bringing, you know, this process to realization. But certainly, you know, at the moment where I can walk from Gatecrashers down the hall and, you know, down the elevator into Nellie Mae Rowe and back, that's going to be a real amazing moment to feel like all this research and all this time, you know, is being seen through art and through the art of these artists for the first time, for sure.
Yeah, and hopefully, you know, it'll open the doors. You know, so many people, as you said, will be seeing a lot of this work for the first time, and they're going to become interested in it, and it will kind of send them on a journey that you've been on for these many years. But I want to say a big thanks to you for joining us today. I hope people will get to see these shows. This is definitely something that I hope will travel. Do we think any of these things will ever go around the country? Is there anybody talk of that?
Yes. So COVID certainly has made some of this complicated, just because of how much it's disrupted museum schedules over the past couple of years. But Gatecrashers is traveling to 2 wonderful institutions in Pennsylvania, actually, the Brandywine River Museum of Art and the Westmoreland Museum of American Art. So those are both institutions that like have a real kind of past with 2 of the important artists in the show, Horace Pippin and John Keane. So it's great that they're going there. That show is going there, and then Nellie Mae Rowe is going to have a big tour, but I can't share the details of that yet.
All right, so top secret.
We'll move around.
Secret until then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good. It'll keep us in suspense. Well, I really appreciate you taking some time to talk with us, and good luck with the shows. And we'll talk to you again someday soon.
I hope so. All right. Thank you so much. See ya. Take care. Bye bye.
Legendary folk artist Grandma Moses died 60 years ago. She was 101. In a 1955 CBS interview with Edward R. Murrow, at a spry 94, she gave some advice on how to be an artist.
What sort of advice would you give to those people if they had time to try their hand at painting?
Well, anybody can paint that wants to paint.
Can they?
Oh, sure. Sure, anybody can paint. And it's best for them to use their own ideas.
Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Additional production assistance from Jack Dean. Theme music by Broncho. For more on the museum and the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.